God is at work in Vegas, but it is still Vegas. We live in a difficult and challenging world, and God is doing all sorts of good things in it. But for now, it is still a difficult and challenging world. God is at work in Vegas, but he doesn't always get what he wants. And this morning we're looking at a passage in Esther where there is a resolution, but is it the resolution that God would want? Is it something that he would celebrate or something that he would grieve? We live in a complicated world. I'm going to read the passage. I'm not going to do much of a recap because the passage actually does some of that for us. So if you've not been with us through Esther, it will explain itself a little bit as we go along. We're reading from the start of Esther 9. Thank you, Kevin. On the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, the edict commanded by the king was to be carried out. On this day, the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them. But now the tables were turned, and the Jews got the upper hand over those who hated them. The Jews assembled in their cities in all the provinces of King Xerxes to attack those determined to destroy them. No one could stand against them because the people of all the other nationalities were afraid of them. And all the nobles of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, and the king's administrators helped the Jews because fear of Mordecai had seized them. Mordecai was prominent in the palace. His reputation spread throughout the provinces. He became more and more powerful. The Jews struck down all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them. And they did what they pleased with those who hated them. In the citadel of Susa, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. They also killed Parshandatha, Delphon, Aspatha, Puratha, Adalia, Aradatha, Parmashta, Arasai, Aradai, and Visatha. That's why they pay us the big bucks. The 10 sons of Haman, son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. But they did not lay hands on the plunder. The number of those killed in the citadel of Susa was reported to the king that same day. The king said to Queen Esther, "The Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men and the 10 sons of Haman in the citadel of Susa. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now what is your petition? It will be given you. And what is your request? It will also be granted." "If it pleases the king," Esther answered, "give the Jews in Susa permission to carry out this day's edict tomorrow also, and let Haman's 10 sons be impaled on poles." So the king commanded that this be done. An edict was issued in Susa, and they impaled the 10 sons of Haman. The Jews in Susa came together on the 14th day of the month of Adar, and they put to death in Susa 300 men, but they did not lay their hands on the plunder. Meanwhile, the remainder of the Jews who were in the king's provinces also assembled to protect themselves and get relief from their enemies. They killed 75,000 of them, but did not lay hands on the plunder. This happened on the 13th day of the month of Adar, and in the 14th they rested and made it a day of feasting and joy. The Jews in Susa, however, had assembled on the 13th and 14th, and then on the 15th they rested and made it a day of feasting and joy. That is why the rural Jews, those living in villages, observe the 14th of month of Adar as a day of joy and feasting, a day for giving presents to each other. Mordecai recorded these events, and he sent letters to all the Jews throughout the provinces of King Xerxes, near and far, to have them celebrate annually the 14th and 15th days of the month of Adar, as the time when the Jews got relief from their enemies, and as the month when their sorrow was turned into joy and their mourning into a day of celebration. He wrote to them to observe the days as days of feasting and joy and giving presents of food to one another and gifts to the poor. So the Jews agreed to continue the celebration they had begun, doing what Mordecai had written to them. For Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to destroy them and had cast the poor, that is the lot, for their ruin and destruction. But when the plot came to the king's attention, he issued written orders against the evil scheme that Haman had devised against the Jews, should come back onto his own head, and that he and his sons should be impaled on poles. Therefore, these days were called Purim, from the word poor. Because of everything written in this letter, and because of what they had seen and what had happened to them, the Jews took it on themselves to establish that day, establish a custom that they and their descendants and all who joined them should without fail observe these 2 days every year in the way prescribed and at the time appointed. These days should be remembered and observed in every generation by every family and in every province and in every city. And these days of Purim should never fail to be celebrated by the Jews, nor should the memory of those days die out amongst their descendants. So Queen Esther, daughter of Abihail, along with Mordecai the Jew, wrote with a full authority to confirm the second letter concerning Purim, And Mordecai sent letters to all the Jews in the 127 provinces of Xerxes' kingdom, words of goodwill and assurance, to establish these days of Purim at their established times, as Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther had decreed for them, and as they had established for themselves and their descendants in regard to their times of fasting and lamentation. Esther's decree confirmed these regulations about Purim, and it was written down in the records. King Xerxes imposed tribute throughout the empire to its distant shores. All his acts of power and might, together with a full account of the greatness of Mordecai, whom the king had promoted, are they not written in the books of the annals of the kings of Media and Persia? Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Xerxes, preeminent amongst the Jews and held in high esteem by his many fellow Jews, because he worked for the good of all his people and spoke up for the welfare of the Jews. So we've come to the end of the cycle of the book of Esther. Sorry. In the first couple of chapters, so chapter 1 and 2, we kind of start over here. And Xerxes is king over a huge empire. He gets rid of his queen for not doing everything that he says and puts out a command that every husband should be able to do exactly the same, which is not great. He brings Esther into the palace and she becomes his queen. And things are looking pretty good. But then, in chapters 3 and 4, Haman comes to power and he looks to destroy the Jews. And there is an edict kind of put out that all of the Jews are going to be destroyed on this particular day. And there's dismay and panic and grieving and mourning. But in the midst of this, Mordecai and Esther start to plan. And then in chapters 5 and 6, the story starts to turn. And Haman's authority is undermined, and Mordecai starts to rise, and Esther works a plan that enables her to accuse Haman at just the right moment. And all through this, God is at work. And then in chapters 7 and 8, Esther and Mordecai get to write edicts. They get to send commands. They get to undo, to some extent, what has been done. And so what was written there is undone here. What was planned there is planned against here. And then in chapters 9 and 10, it comes to resolution. And you can kind of see that there's this, this back and forth. The book mirrors itself quite beautifully. Even in the very last section that I read, talking about Xerxes imposing tribute on this great kingdom, it reminds us that we are kind of back where we started. Xerxes is still the king. Xerxes is still in charge. God has not changed the world, but he has changed things for his people. And so we see in this mirroring that this is a partial solution. And as I was thinking about this, I looked at what happens in this chapter 10 and the death and destruction that happens. And does God celebrate this? I don't think the death of 75,000 people will be something that God would celebrate, even if they were the enemies of the Jews. See, because the Bible reminds us that God does not desire anyone to perish. God even invents ways for the banished to come back to him. I think this was a solution that was the best that our hard hearts could allow. See, at one stage when Jesus is talking to some people about divorce in the New Testament, they ask him about it, and he says, well, Moses allowed you to divorce because of your hard hearts. But this is not the way it was from the beginning. See, God has good plans that he wants to work out, and often the limit on that is us, on our hard hearts. I think this solution was the best of a bad lot, but it wasn't something to celebrate. And interesting as well, that the days of Purim, these days that are celebrated, are not the days of the battle. They're the days of rest afterwards. It's the days when the Jews celebrate that they have been delivered, not the days that they are fighting. I think it's a reminder, actually, that we actually aren't excited about war and death, whatever the reason. It's a reminder that God grieves every person killed in conflict, whether they be Ukrainian or Russian, whether they be Palestinian or Israeli, God grieves the loss of his children. So this is a solution, but it's not a great solution. This is what happens in this world. And one day we look forward to a full resolution. One day we look forward to God coming and making all things right. But for the moment, we see some things made right, or as right as they can be. So within the mirroring that we see in this passage, there is mercy shown, not just justice. We go back to Esther 3, so back over here when Haman's in charge. Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with instructions to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. When that's mirrored over here, chapter 8, then he sent letters saying that the king had allowed the Jews who were in every city to gather and defend their lives, to destroy, kill, and annihilate any armed force of any people or province who might attack them, children and women included, to plunder their goods on one day throughout all the provinces of King Xerxes on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Now, the women and children is that might be attacked. So it's the Jewish women and children. Same. You see in here that even as Esther and Mordecai write to undo this edict, they don't write the same things. So it goes from being, in Esther 3, what would be a genocide, a killing of men and women and children. When the Jews are allowed to respond, they are allowed to respond to what is much more a conventional military action, to defend themselves against armed people coming against them, to fight against the warriors of another people group or nation, anyone that hates them. So it's not necessarily focusing on a particular people group. And so, and is limited to one day. This is not, well, firstly, this is a command from a pagan king, not from God. But also, it is limited. It is not something that sets a precedent. It's not something that goes, hey, look, you can do this whenever you feel like it. It is for this day. And so in the midst of this really challenging situation, and for Esther and Mordecai, really scary, all of their families and the families of their people are at risk. They write with mercy to say, hey, look, you know, actually, when we defend ourselves, we do it right. This is not about women and children. This is not about wiping people out. And when in chapter 9 they go out and do it, the rest of the Jews who were in the king's provinces also gathered to defend their lives and got relief from their enemies and killed 75,000 of those who hated them. But they laid no hands on the plunder. See, they decided that they weren't going to profit from this. They decided that deliverance was enough. They decided that actually being free of whatever pressure had been on them, whatever had been against them, was enough. They didn't need to take the plunder, the belongings, the wealth of the people that they had to kill. And so that was left for the women and children who were left behind. See, there is mercy shown even when the tables are turned. And if you read books like Ezra and Nehemiah, you can kind of see some of the pressure that the Jews were under, even outside of this command of the this edict that allowed them to be killed. You see that they were under pressure from the people around them. They were threatened. They were at risk. And so getting relief, not just from that edict, but from the kind of the general pressure that they were under. And as you see down the bottom here, they're celebrating Purim as the days on which the Jews got relief from their enemies, and as the month that had been turned for them from sorrow into gladness and mourning into a holiday. So again, it's this shift, not celebrating a victory, but celebrating relief, going from the kind of this fear and discomfort through to being free from that. So it's, again, not about the victory, not about winning, not about the war, but about the outcome of that. And there's a really great passage in Lord of the Rings. I love not the sword for its sharpness, it carries on, but only what it defends. But I also love at the end here that as they celebrate this, as they feast and as they gather, they send gifts of food to one another and gifts to the poor. So it's not just about them. When Xerxes at the start of the book is celebrating how amazing his realm is, he has a select few that are in this feast for 180 days. And they get to, they drink as much as they like, and everybody else in the entire empire ends up paying for it. Here, when the Jews celebrate, actually the poor are blessed as well. The poor are included in this celebration. And so even though the tables are turned, there is mercy shown. So some of the thoughts that I had around this, firstly that injustice is not undone by more injustice. That if something is wrong, we can't do another wrong to make it right. Actually, all the time when we are thinking about this stuff, when Esther and Mordecai were thinking about this, resolving this problem, they decided that they couldn't create more injustice. And I think it's really, really helpful to remind ourselves, again, that is this good for everyone? Is this thing that is happening just good for me, or is it good for everyone? Because we all have this this drive for justice. It shows up really quickly from about toddlers on up, that's not fair. And we're really good for justice when it applies to us. We can see it from a mile off. But do we see it when it's other people? Do we do what is fair and just and right? And do we think about the consequences? When I was probably 6 or 7, playing Blind Man's Bluff in the backyard of my grandmother's house. And my older brother decided that while I was blindfolded, he would lure me onto one of her, a raised garden bed made out of a tractor tire. And so I fell into this garden and wasn't very pleased about it. And I decided to get him back. But the thing that I led him onto was a tin surround around a plant, which sliced open his shin, and he needed stitches. Injustice is not undone by another injustice. And that leads on to the second point, which is getting relief is different to getting revenge. Actually, you can have that pressure removed from you without putting that pressure onto somebody else. That actually, real deliverance is not just shifting the focus of injustice, but removing it. And I think it's so important to hold on to this when we are considering big world events and small ones, things in our own neighborhoods, things in our own family, actually not just shifting the focus of injustice, but relieving it, is so key to the things that we're invited to do with Jesus. This is not rocket science. The more power you have, the more important limitations are on having more important limitations on that power are. Lord Acton said that power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. We're all in danger when we are in power, and we need to make sure that we accept and recognize limitations on that power. That we call others to do the same. That we, if we are the boss, that actually we recognize that our authority is limited. If we're in government, whatever that is, we need limitations on that because we don't deal with power well. And I kind of started musing, can Mordecai avoid becoming another Memucan or Haman? Because at the end of the story, he is powerful in the court of Persia, and there are very few limits on his power. Proverbs warns us that if a king listens to lies, all his officials become wicked. There's this opportunity, this chance where having power and knowing that you can get away with stuff can be hugely corrupting. In chapter 9, the king responds to the killing of 500 men in Susa in a really interesting way. Mostly when I've read this, I've thought, oh, he's surprised, he's a bit worried about this. But actually, knowing what we know about Xerxes, knowing what we have found out about him so far, and about what happens next, I think he is egging them on. The king said to Queen Esther, in Susa, the citadel, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men and also the 10 sons of Haman. What then have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now what is your wish? It shall be granted you. And what is further your request? It shall be fulfilled. He's egging them on. And there was up to 2 months between when Haman was killed and when the edict went out to allow the Jews to defend themselves. I think they would have taken time to think about this. But here, Esther just responds off the bat. If it pleases the king, let the Jews who are in Susa be allowed tomorrow to do according to today's edict, and let the 10 sons of Haman be hanged on gallows. I think this is overreach. Because the original edict allowed those who hated the Jews to attack them on one day. And these 300, they end up killing another 300 men. None of them showed up the day before. None of them came out against the Jews, armed and ready to attack them. None of them. Did they have to hunt them down on the second day? Did they have to pull them out of their houses? This is overreach. And power corrupts. I think we need to be hugely careful about our motivations. About even when our blood is up, even when we get on top, even when we start seeing the tables turn, it doesn't mean that the wrong things are gone. God warns Cain, sin is crouching at the door and it wants to master you. We have to be so careful because God is at work in Vegas, but it's still Vegas. And we are still from Vegas. And we have absorbed the culture. We have to be so careful when we take sides to make sure that we're not doing wrong. Because whatever side we're on, we can do wrong. Even we feel like we're on God's side. And so I think while the Jews celebrated the relief, they celebrated the deliverance, I don't think that they or we celebrate the killing. I think we recognize sometimes that there is necessary wrong. And I don't think this is what God wanted, but I think within the limits of hard human hearts, it was what was needed. But let's keep this clear in our heads. This is not something that God celebrates. And as we have come to the end of the book of Esther, and we see the story going through its whole arc, and the work of God in the background, the work of God who was never mentioned in the book, but who brings about deliverance through these shifts and coincidences and timing and moments. It works through people. It works through people who are limited. It works through people who are sinful. God's deliverance comes through the people that he has at the time. And what kind of people are they? The next time God needs to deliver someone, what kind of people has he got around them? And we're invited into this. Oh, sorry, actually, I missed that bit. because we don't want to end up here. So Esther is in power, Esther and Mordecai. It reminded me of in Exodus 1, when the Jews are in Egypt. The more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel, so they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves. Just a reminder, even the good guys can end up in this place where they are afraid of the people they are oppressing, and so oppress them more. That happened to the Jews there. It could happen here. Anywho, I'll remember that next time. We're invited into making things right. In 1 Peter, which actually is written in the midst of persecution. It's a letter written when the people are under pressure, much in the same way that the Jews were under pressure. It is a time where Christians were being killed. But it says, finally, all of you, be like-minded, be sympathetic, love one another, be compassionate and humble. Do not repay evil with evil or insult with insult. On the contrary, repay evil with blessing, because to this you were called, that you may inherit a blessing. For whoever would love life and see good days must keep their tongue from evil and their lips from deceitful speech. They must turn from evil and do good. They must seek peace and pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are attentive to their prayer. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. And isn't it interesting that verse 12, talking about the righteous and those who do evil, it doesn't name a people. It doesn't name a side. It doesn't name a group. It labels actions. We are invited to be righteous by what we do, and not to do evil. Because it's a fine distinction, but actually God is not on our side. We are supposed to be on his, and then he is with us. But if we have a side that God is not on, then no matter what our relationship with him is, he's not on that side. We are invited to show mercy, to extend the love of God into difficult situations where we're persecuted, where we're struggling, where things are in chaos. We don't take revenge. We seek to relieve injustice. This is what we are invited to. And we're not going to solve it all in this world. This world is still going to be Vegas for a while. It's still going to be dark. It's still going to be chaotic. And we are simply invited to do what we can with what we have and to allow God to lead us in that. And that means following his commands. Gentleness and compassion and hope, even in tough situations. And yes, sometimes there has to be justice, but not to overdo it. Not to let it run wild or to overreach. We are invited to this kind of world. A world where we bring light and not darkness. A world where we bring order and not chaos. And ultimately, it's because of what Jesus has done for us that we are reminded that good can overcome evil, but it doesn't come without suffering. And so sometimes we suffer and we bless. Sometimes we are under pressure and we seek relief, but we don't seek revenge. At the end, I think this is the invitation of the tail end of the book of Esther for us. Because God is at work in our lives, but not so that we can do the wrong things, but so that we can enjoy the good things that he is doing and extend it to other people. As in the celebration of Purim, to send gifts of food to one another and gifts to the poor. Actually, it goes beyond us. And we are invited to take that part in the world. So let's pray. Father, we acknowledge that our hearts are hard. God, we would sometimes like to just have you on our side. And Father, I pray that you would be helping us to continue to look to you, to turn our eyes toward you, to allow you to speak into our lives and challenge us in the places where our hearts are hard, or where we are overreaching, or where our motivations are wrong. Father, lead us to become more like you. Father, help us to extend mercy and compassion even to those who hate us. And Father, as we do this, as we are challenged and as we are changed, Father, help us to celebrate the good things you are doing by sharing them with other people. Lord, we want to be yours, and we want to choose your ways. Kia tātou te aroha noa, o te ariki ihukareiti. May the grace of the Lord Jesus Christ be with you all.